The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So, we continue in our exploration of koans. And the pleasure of this for me is that I get to pick one of my greatest hits. I get to pick one that is particularly alive for me and was particularly alive when I first encountered it. And that's really what these ancient stories are for. That not everyone resonates in quite the same way, but that as we encounter them, some of them leap off the page or creep off the page and into your heart. This one did for me. So the koan I'd like to talk about comes again from the miscellaneous koans. And this is this small collection of koans that happens right after we begin, right after the cycle of Mu. And these are small snippets of text, small stories. Some of the later ones, as you know, can be very long. They can be Shaggy Dog stories. And these are just little jewels. So, here's one that was a jewel for me. It's case 21 from the miscellaneous koans. Once a woman raised a goose in a bottle. When the goose was grown, she wanted to get it out. How can you get it out without breaking the bottle? Once a woman raised a goose in a bottle. When the goose was grown, she wanted to get it out. How can you get it out without breaking the bottle? But when I first encountered this koan, it was like, huh? What? and so when I have that huh reaction, I kick into logical mind problem-solving mode, which we've all been so well trained to do. And I thought of all these ways. And, well, how could you get the goose out? Maybe there's some, I mean, do they have flexible joints? I mean, what are you doing with it? And I actually Googled the little shipbuilding things where you build those tiny ships. And I thought, well, if you could build a ship in one of those, how could you get the goose out? So I was doing this and just getting nowhere, as you can imagine. And it went on for a while, and teachers would sort of smile at me as I'd come in with my latest effort. And they were nice. They didn't just sternly ring me out. They smiled and almost patted me on the head metaphorically, but sent me on my way. And I just thought, I'm getting nowhere with this. And one morning, it was like 4 a.m., and I'm sure you know the demons that can arrive at 4 a.m. And I was lying there. It was cold. It was February, I think. Really cold. And the furnace wasn't working right, and we didn't know what was wrong, so the house was really cold, so we were kind of shivering. And I had some work deadlines, and I didn't know how I was going to get them met. And my then teenage son was mad at me about something, and I was the worst parent ever. And then this koan, I wasn't getting anywhere with this koan. And I was lying there, just feeling so sorry for myself. And actually, because of the cold, I was lying there all curled up in the fetal position. And suddenly, I had this flash of, I'm the goose. This is the bottle. This this life that I am feeling so confined by. This is the bottle I'm in right now. And suddenly, I had great appreciation for whoever that ancient teacher was centuries ago, who put this image down and taught it and said, yeah, human life can really feel like this. It can feel so cramped and so confining and no way out. And then, first of all, I remember lying there in the dark at 4 a.m. starting to giggle and realizing that, you know, people were asleep, my wife was next to me, but suddenly there was this kind of moment of, oh, oh. And then I began to do what we are encouraged to do when we explore koans, which is to look at each part of the koan and become each part of the koan. And it was really easy to be the goose, this cramped creature. And I had been put in there tiny, and then I grew, and I was just doing what I was supposed to do. I just grew up. And how did I know it was going to be this much of a prison? And then I thought, well, who would raise a goose in a bottle? What kind of... who? And of course the woman, you know, can go to parents so easily, but then, of course, my karma was so much, so many causes and conditions brought me to that place. And if you think about it, think about you right now. All the causes and conditions that bring you to this place, to this cushion, to moments where you feel like this is terrible drudgery and you're trapped and there's no way out. Yeah, we can think about parents, we can think about great-grandparents, we can think about the karma of being born as this gender, as this race, in this time in human history. So many causes and conditions that make each of our bottles unique. And then, as we started to talk about yesterday in the Dharma dialogue, I began to realize that the person putting me in the bottle much of the time was right here, me. We talked yesterday about those things that we want to get away from, those ways that we are, my anger, my anxiety. And we talked about how they can actually start out as seeming like really useful strategies and being useful strategies. Pleasing people, giving people what they want. Oh, such a useful strategy, makes people happy. And then they become habits, they become the habits that we can't get away from. And so often, the things that make us want to crawl into those protective bottles in the first place are the things that start to confine us as we want to grow and as we want to spread our wings. We also choose bottles or containers, if I want to put it a little more gently. We choose the container of Zen. I mean, Zen is all made up. It's all a creation over hundreds and hundreds of years. And we choose it because it allows us to bump up against all the mistakes we make in bowing in the Kinhin line, ringing the bell, chanting. And we choose this container because it's a vehicle for waking up. But even this is a bottle. And eventually, as the teaching goes, we will have to take this raft across the river and then leave the raft behind. That even these beautiful forms of Zen, this magnificent bottle that we choose to be in, is just that. And then, of course, there is the bottle, the confining space of being born a human, of having a mind and a body and a heart. Dogen glimpsed this really clearly. He wrote beautifully about what it must look like to a fish to swim in the ocean. What does the ocean look like? And what does the ocean look like if you're a bird? And what does the ocean look like if you are a man sitting in a boat in the middle of the ocean? Dogen had the imagination to understand how relative our sense of the world is, how confined, how limited. I sometimes think that some of our sports like scuba diving or skydiving are our attempts to have the imaginative leaps that Dogen had. This is what it's like to be a fish under the water. This is what it's like to be a bird flying through the air. Glimpses of knowing what it's like outside of our human bottle. And so the invitation of practice is just to look, to investigate all of this, to see the little hell realm that I was in at 4 in the morning and see it for what it is. Just something that morphs and changes and is a creation of my mind. That all those realms that you cycle through each day here on the cushion, all to be noted, appreciated, lived, and held lightly and let go, even the joyous, the blissful, the deep samadhi, all just creations. Of course, sometimes we get glimpses of our true nature. We get glimpses where there is no bottle, where we are truly one with everything. And those glimpses can be magnificent, they can be terrifying. I think of Marianne Williamson's poem that starts this way. She says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. And what she's speaking to is that experience of our true nature where the bottles fade away and we are just able to spread our wings because we are one with all of it, with the vast, powerful universe, magnificent beyond measure. And of course, that too doesn't last. So we come back and we find ourselves cranky or hungry or in pain. And we notice again that life begins to close in, and there we are, this big cramped goose. But this invitation of practice to keep investigating over and over again, to appreciate every bit of it, that is the jewel that Zazen offers us. And this is what Uchiyama wrote about in our reading. When you accord with Buddha Dharma, your true self is the entire world. And in this world, there is no possibility of exchange. The life of the true self is not apart from our functioning. Everything we encounter is our life. Everything. Old, dirty bottles. Magnificent realms of bliss. All of it is our life. All of it to be investigated. And all of it invited by this little koan showing us that yes, this goose in the bottle, this is the starting place. This is the seed. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Thank you. So, please sit comfortably. Comments?
And a reminder that this is being recorded, so if you don't want your words recorded, we'll just shut it off.
Yeah. Susan.
Thank you for sharing this cover with. I came across this version the very first time in the 90s. And I didn't understand at all. And then it was gone for many, many years. And I loved the way you were touching it. And it reminded me of what we always chant when we say, I vow to enter each Dharma gate. And it is so difficult to do this.
Yeah.
It is so difficult to do this.
Yeah.
It's easy to decide to enter a Dharma gate when I have a sense that I feel safe or that I can manage it or, you know, that it's under control, whatever this means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when there is a sense of no control,
yeah,
and there is just this bottle.
Yeah.
Or at least it feels sometimes like this bottle. And thank you for the reminder that the ghost was never in the bottle in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Susan, you're talking about something so important, which is that, yes, we say, you know, look at the bottle, look at the prison you feel that you're in, look at the hell realm, and yet sometimes we just can't. Sometimes we just don't have the resources to face toward. And that's okay, because it will still be there, right? It's not lost. The opportunity is not lost as long as we're alive and as long as we're able to come back. And you're saying sometimes it's just not possible to face directly toward a painful place.
Well, and I appreciate too how romantic all this stuff is until it yeah. happens to us.
Yes,
you know, yes, go into the not knowing, and when we're and that sometimes all of us have the capacity to do this when we feel sort of grounded and centered, and I can do it. But indeed, what we're asked to do is to step forward with no guarantees. Right, and this requires all of our heart. This requires us to do something we cannot do, and you saying so clearly, this is so hard, and this is our invitation. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I was thinking about the reason it's, I mean, so hard is, I mean, I immediately thought of the bottle saying, well, that's ego, that's construct itself, and so, I mean, it's very, it's built up as automatic, I mean, largely armored to do, sorry, how do I...
Keep doing it.
I guess what I was going to say is, it's really, there's a certain fear that comes up, a certain discomfort, craving, aversion, desire to do maladaptive things that comes up whenever there's like a real action against that kind of a shell, cocoon, the glass bottle, etc. So it requires just an incredible amount of executive control to keep acting and acting, and I can't... My sense is it gets easier to bring more of your life into the fold the more you've been practicing, but even then, I remember apparently Suzuki Roshi, he almost drowned in a pool, and he was like,
"Oh yeah,
hey, I'm not ready to die. I'm afraid of this or something. I have an attachment to myself still. Yeah. My heart is so impure."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love what you're saying, David. You know, the one of the important things for me about this koan is that it says, "How do you get the goose out without breaking the bottle?" So, you know, we think ego, my shell, I'm gonna just, you know, you could just get a hammer, release the goose, but it doesn't work that way. So that this coming to terms with embracing, like Suzuki Roshi, you know, I don't want to die drowning right now. This is something so important to face into. You know, the going through the Dharma gate, what's going to happen? You know, is something really going to be destroyed if we really encounter our ego? This is similar to what we were talking about yesterday about embracing the demons, embracing the reality of the situation, and not thinking we have to get rid of stuff. You know, and it's pretty, I think you were referring to it, Bob, in that talk. This life, this bottle, don't break it. But feel thoroughly what it's like to be. I just pictured you, the little goose.
Yeah.
In your bed in the cold at 4 a.m. Yeah. And that glass, you know, I always think of it as like one of those really thick glass-walled bottles, because that's what the ego feels like. you're pointing to something that I can resonate with, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it sort of relates to what David's saying. I want to point out how appreciative I am that you pointed out that Zen is a made-up thing. And that we have agreed to follow Zen and to follow the forms. And so that whenever we bump up against a form, right there is the Dharma gate, the opening. Yeah. And if we decide that, you know, I don't like this particular form, so I'm just not going to do it, we're cheating ourselves out of that. Yeah. We're bypassing the Dharma gate, and we've just lost an opportunity. Yeah. And so that, you know, facing that ego is hard, but it's really hard. That's where it is.
Yeah, bumping up against things hurts. You know, I also want to just say, I think both of you, Susan and David, are talking about, you know, we think of like the liberation that could come getting out of the bottle, but it's scary, and you're both pointing to that we're talking about something that can feel so confining, a sense of, you know, what's familiar. Even though we say we want to be rid of it, it's so familiar, it's so known, and stepping out of that can be terrifying. And you're saying it takes a whole lot of, both of you are saying, it takes a whole lot of perseverance and energy and bravery.
And I just want to affirm all of that is true. And I always use this analogy that, you know, we're on the edge of a cliff and we're practicing really hard and we think we're going to, you know, that if we go into the unknown, into the dark, we're going to fall off a cliff and, you know, go, ah. But what if the cliff is just the land is just a couple of inches away?
Yeah.
You know, and that's been my experience often.
Yes.
Oh. But we don't know until we do it. That's the thing. It feels before we do it. I've had this experience over and over again. Oh my God, what's going to happen? And what are they going to think? And what's going to happen? My ego will fly into a million pieces. And kitchen. It's not such a big deal. Of course, other times it is like, whoa, everything does fall away. But you just don't know. So why not take a step off the 100-foot pole, as we say, and just see. Kitchen.
Yeah.
See what happens.
I was totally thinking of the 100-foot pole, right? When you started talking, I was remembering when I was a teenager, we would go to the Tipton quarries, and I would jump off cliffs, and every time I jumped off, I was like, I'm going to die now, in that visceral way. Like that feeling of just, you're going to die. And then I went to a quarry in Rockport, and this teenager was, I was not at 17 anymore, I was like, I'm going to go jump. And I was like, I'm going to jump too. I'm going to jump. And it was so scary.
Mm.
And we jumped at the same time. And I landed in water and I swam back. And that, it's just, that feeling is so familiar in my life. But mostly in those experiences. And bringing that to bear. Yes, it was a cliff. The 100-foot pole. You know, you can die jumping off a cliff pretty easily.
Yeah.
But in these internal things, like you said, it's usually, for me, not as bad as I think. Although, a lot of shifts happen and changes come about in my relationships there's something else other than what I think I'm clinging to isn't. There's always something more. There's something else beyond it, beyond what I think the bottle is.
I love what you're saying. It resonates with what I was feeling just a few moments ago. And I have all this stuff going on in my head about, you know, all the metaphors we're using, jumping off the cliff, the bottle, the going through the Dharma gates, you know, all of these things. I just keep thinking about one of my favorite poems from Rumi, which is like 3 pages long, so I'm not going to recite the whole thing. But one of the points he makes in this poem, which is called The Question, which is essentially what happens, you know, who are you really? He says, well, imagine this. Imagine that you're sitting in front of a big fire and a pool of water. And this is always our choice. And he says, but here's the thing. The people who choose to go in the water end up in the fire. And the people who go into the fire end up in the water.
Yeah.
And I always thought, right, no matter what happens, life's going to get you.
Yeah.
So we can choose the, no, I'm just going to, you know, and then suddenly our whole life burns up. And then, or we can say, no, I'm brave, I'm courageous, I'm going to go for it. And then we're floating in the water, which is similar to what actually happened to you. And then he goes on, and the rest of the poem, and says, and you know what? There's no fire, and there's no water. Mm. It's just a trick of the mind that God has created for us to give us the idea that we have a choice. Right? Yeah. Just take the next step.
Yeah. Esther.
So, I've had a surprising person of my life sitting with me this entire retreat. He showed up when Mike talked about sitting on the bench watching mango trees with his father. So my father arrived. And he's been here with me on the retreat a lot in my thoughts. And what I...
A little louder.
So, and this, you know, talking about the bottled goose and the light. So I'm thinking the bottled goose... there's still the light inside the bottled goose.
Mm.
You know, however crammed we are, and to find, you know, the courage to be that bottled up goose with the light and show up in our relationships and walk together. Mm. And so this little piece, you know, as I walk with my dad recently, a complete new experience. He's been living away in another country for many years, came back to Denmark. We walked by a big lake. And there was a sense of freedom, and still a sense of bottled-up gooseness with the light.
Yeah, yeah,
and also, you know, something, just a little inter quote about, you know, we practice not just for ourselves, but for everyone around us. And I see something, the light in my father's bottled-up goose. And we were there, and suddenly we heard the sound of eagles, which is kind of rare. And there was a big sea eagle circling above my head. And my father looked up. And in that moment, the intimacy of just seeing the eagle, right, everything fell away.
No bottles. No, no.
And just no bottles.
Yeah.
And I just,
You know, I love what you're saying about, you know, that even if I'm, like, in a bottle, caught in a bottle, there's still light. And I can still manifest that light. And I can still see other people's light. And I think that the whole point of this is that we are always constrained. We always live with constraints. Just being human, but certainly then our own individual karmic constraints. And to, you know, to say, but still, rather than it being a reason not to show up, not to be there in the world sharing the light we have, you're saying we can still do that. Yes, the constraints are there, and I think that's so important.
Who says it's not a luminous goose?
Yeah, it's a luminous
goose. Luminous goose.
It's a luminous goose.
We already gave you a Dharma.
Luminous goose. Ooh, I like that.
And what would life be without constraints?
Right. Yes. Right. Right. That's why we do Zen.
It's say more.
Can you imagine? I can't imagine.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, and that's what you were saying. This is the opportunity. The constraint is the skin. We can say is the container, but it is what touches the world. You know, I touch and am touched by. So is this the barrier or is this the bridge?
Right.
Right? And then, right, then all this talk about bottles is silly.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
A quick one.
No, quick one.
I was thinking of, I think it's Dogen who's talking about, he has some passage...
a bird can fly.
Just a little bit louder.
Oh, a bird.
I'm sensitive to people with hearing issues.
The passage from Dogen, he's like, a bird can fly for miles and never reach the end of the sky. And a fish can, and see in the water.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe you can't grow geese outside of bottles. Maybe there's some zoning law.
There's some zoning law.
Sound control.
Well, and like you cannot grow a human being without an ego.
Right.
Like if you didn't have an ego, you'd really be in trouble.
Mm.
Now you're only sort of in trouble. but there's a zoning law.
I keep saying it this session, I don't know why, but Dogen keeps saying like recognition is already delusion. Like to see something and say that's a bowl, that's a cushion.
Yeah,
that's right. Already, and kind of we can't think without that.
Right.
We're already there.
Yeah.
Right.
Because it implies that we think we know something and then we can dismiss it. Right? Instead of staying present to what is this?
Right.
And we do this with interactions as well. We decide who the other person is. And then we're lost, because then we're just talking to a box.
Mm.
We're not talking to a mystery. Mm. Yeah. And the same thing when we think we know what the outcome's going to be. Then we're stuck.
Well, and Okamura, in that passage we read today, say the mind creates a map of reality, and you cannot get rid of your maps of reality. But you can know that there is a map, and we can have these experiences where we see, to call it a floor is to miss the intimacy with it. Great.
Yeah.
That's it.
How are we doing?
One or two more.
Maybe there's another.
I would just add to that, and to call it a David.
To
call it a Melissa. That's where the missing the intimacy.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was thinking too, thank you, you just jogged my memory. People can't grow without, what did you say? Without what?
Ego.
Without ego.
Yeah.
We also can't grow without suffering.
Right.
We can't exist. There's that wonderful experiment that I was so impressed by from a long time ago, where they tried to build an artificial environment out west somewhere, and with a dome over it, and the trees just wouldn't grow because there was no wind, there was no rain, there was no rocks they had to get through. So that's to appreciate again, the fire is not a problem, the suffering is not a problem, although it hurts, ouch. It's still we can bow to it.
When you said a miscellaneous coin, I was thinking the goose. And I had a hard time with this because I'm very literal, and I saw hens in battery cages. And I was in a bottle with this koan.
Because it's
all the horrible things I see, and somehow there's, even without making a metaphor out of it, like there's that too, like koans aren't metaphors. I don't have to find out what the goose represents.
And we do, we do horrible things to animals. We do horrible things to other people. We put other people in cages, literally, unfortunately, these days. And that there are ways in which we can do this to each other. And I think that's it's really important to bring it in, right? To say this is not just in the inner realm that we're talking about, what we do to ourselves. We're talking about real cruelty out there in the world.
And working with koans, it's not about figuring out the metaphor.
Right.
think this is really important, because when we're taught to read poetry, you're supposed to figure out, well, what does this mean? Well, the wheelbarrow is really, you know, this, you know, whatever.
It's the white chicken.
Yeah, yeah. So I appreciate you saying that as we enter in. There's some entering in, but it's not the this means that. It's more engaging with it in some other way. So even those of us that aren't good with metaphor can still find a way into some immediacy of this sinking in and touching us in some places we don't even have to understand in some ways.
Well, and we were saying at the beginning of this sesshin, so we're talking about koans, and in Boundless Way we have three ways of working with koans now. There's this, where a teacher gives a talk about a koan and is very careful not to reveal the answer or an answer. Sometimes it's a very delicate thing, right? Mm-hmm. And then the Dharma dialogue, you know, where we explore it. And so we'll in this form of working with koans, there's some intellectual stuff that rises, there's some metaphoric stuff, and it's all welcome. You know, you don't have to. In the koan salons, the same thing happens, that we spark each other's metaphors and stuff. But in the third way, which is the one-on-one teacher-student way, this very thing which comes up then gets elicited and shaped into your own realization of something that is unique to you. And I think that's why I love that doksan with koans is, you know, it's amazing. If you haven't experienced it yet, maybe you'll be inspired to come and say, I want to work with koan, I want that. And then, gosh, you know, we'll see what it's like for you. But it is, so we're just to know that the language of koans has many dialects. I guess that's what I'm thinking. Mm. Right? And everyone speaks their own.
Even the literal can get something out of it.
Yeah. Oh, especially. I'm thinking of a person who's no longer a part of our organization, who had absolutely no capacity for metaphor and was the most brilliant koan person. But whenever a metaphor would come, they would like it. Oh no, a metaphor, and would have to settle. And you just know everybody's different.
And to. All of you are working on koans.
Yes.
Mm. So the danger of talking like this makes it sounds like there's something really special that's different.
Right.
But you know, your life is your koan.
Exactly.
Right? And not an easy thing to deal with. So, and each moment as we sit, each breath, each period, so the koan... Ray signals the beginning of the koan. Dong, dong. How will you meet this moment? So this kind of meeting the moment is the koan. This moment is the koan. And you can do it with these stories, and we're sort of exploring how wonderful it is. For the first 15 years I practiced, there was some koan, but a lot of shikantaza, and still now my main practice is meeting the moment, the koan of this moment, and playing with it. So I want to make sure we don't fall over into...
Yeah.
If you're a real student here, you are a real student here, and you are working on koans. Make no mistake about
it.
Oh, and just a little postscript to that. Many people start working on koans and then say, this is not for me. And if you're sitting thinking, oh gosh, I failed, instead you solved your koan. This is not for me.
Right.
And people do koans, stop, never do koans, fall in love with koans. It goes back to what Jenny's saying. You know, is there room for even a literal person? There's room for everybody.
Oh yeah.
The Dharma is infinitely wide and vast. Thank goodness.
Right, I was just going to say that if you think about the things we are talking about here, you don't need this koan. You all don't need this koan to be exploring these matters, to be exploring what it feels like to feel confined, and then say, who's confining me, and all that, all that stuff naturally comes up on the cushion, as we're all saying, and so
you can suffer naturally.
You can suffer naturally without koan, no koan. It doesn't matter.
In a moment, maybe Steve will be the last one. But and just to say that for me, I really do love koans. So this is and it's an unusual thing, and there's no other teaching form in the spiritual world that uses koans. And for some reason, that's one of the reasons why. Yes, Zen for me. So, but everybody's got to find their own way.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say I appreciate the fact that you went back to one that you've already passed.
Yeah.
And that they keep opening, don't they?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They really do.
This was a surprise to me. You know, mm-hmm. I figured, okay, we passed through that Dharma gate, we're gone. You know, we're 5 miles down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you go through that gate.
Yeah.
And it's different. So anyway, I just wanted to say how much I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and if I could just say one more small thing.
Yeah.
As teachers, we go over the koans, the same koans, over and over and over again, right? Because everybody who comes in is working with a koan, or with breath practice, or with shikantaza, we have to reconsider that practice for ourselves in order to be with the person. So this is more of a circle practice than it is heading through all the Dharma gates and getting to the goal at the end.
You know, and I just want to add that, you know, first of all, thank you, and that, you know, I come back to Sesshin for the umpteenth time, and I'm sitting there and saying, oh my God, this is coming up again. I'm dealing with this again. And so my sense is that this circular practice, the koans remain alive, my internal craziness comes back again, doesn't go away, you know, it is our life. I guess so on that note, on that cheery note.
So we'll just come back and